Station number 877.
Field Marshal Carver, Reel 1. I want to start 1934, just to get a little background about the circumstances that led you into the Tank Corps. First, what were your reasons for joining the Army, and what were the circumstances under which you joined it?
Well, my principal reason for joining the Army was that my father, who was in the cotton trade, in a family firm in the cotton trade, although he hadn't actually lost his job at that time, had been told that it would come to an end within 2 years, at the age of about 57, and he had 3 sons at Winchester and 1 at Dartmouth. At least the youngest hadn't gone to Winchester at that time. And he said, sorry, but there is no money. First of all, I may not have the money even to pay your final school bills, but I certainly can't afford to send you to university or into a profession which demands any length of training which costs any great deal of money. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? I already had a brother. My elder brother had already decided to go into the Air Force, in fact was at Cranwell at that time. My youngest brother, younger brother was at Dartmouth. And so my plot, in fact, was to study for another profession while spending 3 or 4 years in the Army. As I understood, you didn't have to work frightfully hard and you could just about exist on your pay if you went into a cheap regiment.
I was going to ask you if you came from a service family, but with a brother in the Navy and another brother in the Air Force, it's...
Yes, but my father, on my father's side, no member of the family had been a regular in the forces at all. They were all connected with Manchester business of some sort. And on my mother's side, gentleman behind you in a buff coat, my great-grandfather was a regular officer. He died in the Crimea. And there were a number of his family were, but not all that number. Mm.
What was the status of the Army as a career at this time between the wars? Did it sort of rate as a profession?
Well, it's always rated as a profession, yes. At Winchester, where I was, people seemed rather surprised that I should choose to go into the Army instead of head of something else, and perhaps I was a bit surprised myself.
Mm-hmm. At what point and for what kind of reasons, while you were at Sandhurst, did you opt for the Tank Corps?
Well, I opted for the Tank Corps really before I went. I mean, I went with it to Sandhurst with the idea of going into the Royal Tank Corps. And this was brought about through my elder brother. At that time, there were a number of Royal Tank Corps officers seconded to the Royal Air Force. And he knew one who was stationed at Worthy Down, which was a night bomber station just outside Winchester. And he suggested to this chap, whose name was Hutchinson, who was killed during the war, that he should get hold of me and that I should get hold of him. So I bicycled out to Worthy Down and actually had my first flight in an aeroplane quite unauthorizedly. It was forbidden by the school and I think forbidden by the Royal Air Force too. In a rear gargana seat of an old Vickers Valencia night bomber, an extremely uncomfortable and frightening experience. And this chap told me about the Royal Tank Corps and gave me photographs of tanks and armoured cars. And I came to the conclusion that was the only sort of part of the Army I really would like to join, because it was something which seemed to me to be forward-looking and one was rather mechanical-minded in those days. I wasn't at all attracted by any other part of the Army, except possibly the Royal Engineers, but I wasn't much of a mathematician and was not going to go to Woolwich.
Was the choice influenced at all by your father's comments about the current situation of the family budget?
Well, it was influenced by my going to a regiment where you could expect to live on your pay and not have to have a private allowance, yes. I mean, my first choice was the Royal Tank Corps. My second choices were ones which I knew nothing about. I had a godfather who was in the 60th in the Royal Rifle Corps and somebody we knew who was in the King's Own Yorkshire Light Infantry, so I put them down as second and third choices, actually.
Did you get any impressions during your appeared as a cadet at Sandhurst, of the contemporary status of the tank corps within the army?
Well, yes, one got an impression that it was certainly not regarded as high in the social scale, but at the same time that it was perhaps a more professional outfit than others, and a corps which was extremely keen on its soldiering and keen on its tanks. And in those days you had a mechanical engineering sort of section that you did, you could choose certain voluntary subjects of which mechanical engineering was one. And I was at that time interested in motorbikes and cars and that's motor racing and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. But I also, of course, it had a very high reputation in the sporting, I mean in the sort of games field, which was not my line.
Surprisingly high in relation to its size.
Yeah, very.
From other officers that I've recorded who served with the tank corps during the 20s and the early 30s, I got the impression from their comments about their Sandhurst experience that the syllabus at Sandhurst paid no attention whatsoever, no cognizance to tanks specifically, and very little attention to mechanization in general. What was your impression in 1935?
Well, they may have better memories than I have, but of course it didn't much, because it was, as today, I mean, they were primarily concerned in instilling into you the basic elements of soldiering, which are basically infantry elements. There wasn't time to do anything else, but I mean, the same would be true, of course, it didn't deal with future gunners and future sappers. They were at Woolwich. Mm. But it didn't deal with really tactics other than extremely low-level infantry tactics, which is what one would expect. I think they're probably imagining something which they thought of afterwards.
Maybe. It's rather more surprising in your case than it is in theirs, that despite the points you've just made, some attention to mechanization wasn't given, since by that stage it was...
Well, presumed. I suppose they're saying, well, you know, everybody had to learn to ride a horse. Why didn't everybody have to learn to ride something about motor vehicles? And the answer was there was a, which I don't think there is now, it's interesting, I mean, there was then a mechanical engineering course which the Royal Tank Corps officer on the staff ran, which gave one very elementary training in what I would call garage work, really.
Right. Russell, Russell, that'll all go down on the tape. you went to Bovington in January 1935. Just a general question to start with. Did your experience at Bovington confirm your expectations that the Tank Corps was going to be a professional and forward-looking kind of regiment?
Yes and no. I was disappointed in finding it rather more what I would call traditional and having a lot of the rather dreary side of army life that I thought it might, I expected it not to have.
For example?
The whole sort of social life in the mess and the whole sort of way one was treated as a young officer was going right back to square one at Sandhurst, and one, it might just as well have been anything else. One somehow thought it would be a bit more forward-looking than it was. But the actual driving and maintenance course and the gunnery course were very interesting and were what one had come there to learn. It was the other side of life didn't seem to be any different from any other part of the army, actually.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. You would have thought that the Tank Corps would have had its own ethos, which would be rather...
Well, it thought it had, but it wasn't all that different.
Mm-hmm. Now, if we can just look at the nuts and bolts of the course... driving and maintenance course, taking them in two parts, the driving, how was that organised and on what vehicles?
You did driving and maintenance, together, really. I mean, you did, as far as I can remember, you spent so many weeks on such and such a vehicle, and the vehicles were wheeled vehicles, ordinary army lorries, as they were then, the Rolls-Royce armoured car, I don't think the Crossley armoured car was still there, but the old Rolls-Royce armoured car one did a certain amount of time on. The Vickers medium tank you spent most time on. And the light tank, I think it was the Mark I or Mark II light tank, with possibly some, and I'm not quite sure if there was anything on the Carden Lloyd carrier. I don't think there was.
How was the driving training focused? I mean, was the intention to give you comparable skills to those of specialist drivers within a tank crew? Was it to that kind of level?
Well, if you say specialist driver, I mean the driver's a driver. Mm. Yes, it was to make you a competent driver, so you would understand the job the man had to do, and try and learn a little bit more, so that you were not actually up to the standard of an instructor at that stage, but that you would be capable of supervising both the maintenance, I mean the trained drivers yourself, when you've got to your unit, and supervise the maintenance of your section, but not actually as much as to be a qualified instructor who would take a course for trade test, I don't think.
Mm. How much attention?
Maybe. Sorry. Maybe, but I can't quite remember that.
How much attention was given to wheeled vehicles in the training? What was the balance of attention?
I should think, but I mean, it's very difficult to say. I should think it was about a fifth of the total, probably. I mean, you started on a wheeled vehicle slightly easier. I mean, there were some people who came on the course who couldn't drive.
Oh, I see. That was the presumption.
Yeah. Mm.
And the wheeled, with the armoured cars being part of tank corps equipment, I can see the point in learning to drive those. Can't see the point in learning to drive a lorry other than teaching a fellow to drive.
You may not have driven anything else but a car, you might not have even driven that. You've got to learn to drive a lorry across country. I mean, across country driving this was. Because you've got to teach people to do this when you go back to your own unit.
The maintenance side of the training, to what kind of level of mechanical ability were tank corps officers trained?
Well, they were supposed to be trained up to the level of everything a driver himself ought to be able to know and do, not what the fitters were, what were called the fitters then, jobs are now done by remit. Although there were certain, in order to understand how the thing worked, you were told a great deal more about the internal workings and things than you actually needed to do just to do a driver's job. But fundamentally, I think it was meant so that, again, your standard was high enough to supervise the driver's maintenance and to be able to train your own drivers in driving and maintenance, but not expected to be up to the level of supervising what a fitter did.
I see. Good. The gunnery course, you trained on what weapons at that time?
The Vickers machine gun, which was fitted into both the light tank and the medium tank. The 3-pounder, which was fitted in the medium tank. And the 3-inch mortar, it was called. It wasn't really a mortar, but it was a very low velocity 3-inch weapon fitted in the close support medium tank, which was used for smoke and HE. Don't think there were any other taught at that time, because there weren't any other machine. The Beezer machine gun hadn't come in then. Mm. I rather think there was a .5 machine gun, but I can't remember. Don't think there was at that time.
And was time divided more or less evenly between?
I haven't the faintest idea.
Okay. What kind of exercises were employed in training you on the gunnery courses?
Well, not exercises, other than the final thing was a troop shoot where you did a sort of three sides of a box. You went straight down and you fired going. You weren't really supposed to fire on the move, I don't think. But you fired, you stopped and fired at intervals like that. You then did a sideways bit, and then you did a bit back again, firing over the rear. That was the last thing, as far as I can remember.
Yes. And in building up to that final thing, were there Did simulated training play any part in the gunnery side?
Well, yes, a thing called a RIPER. I don't know what RIPER stood for. But
roll your... it's a nautical term, isn't it? Roll your something and something.
Roll your and pitch.
Yes.
Assembly, I expect it was. Or roll your and pitch... A. The A was assembly, I expect. Yeah. Well, I mean, it was, as they have today, it was something which simulated the motion and everything else of a tank. And as you have today, you fired a 2-2 bullet, actually, at a model on a sand range. The same sort of thing today.
Mm-hmm. And was there a reasonable opportunity during the gunnery course to fire guns? Were you inhibited by lack of ammunition or anything?
I suspect it was restricted, yes. I mean, I don't remember much, but I don't know what the allotment was. The range, of course, was the Lulworth range, but not quite as much of it as there is today.
How accurate do you think you were at that time?
Very inaccurate, actually. Well, I mean, we could hit stationary targets at the range at which one was supposed to hit them, I think.
Yes.
But the three pounder was a pretty low velocity weapon. I don't think that the results against moving targets were often frightfully accurate.
I remember talking to one officer who was a gunnery instructor, and he said, with the wisdom of hindsight, he felt that the standard of gunnery training was not really geared to operational needs at the time, and specifically he criticised in this final box pattern exercise you described that firing took place at too slow a speeds, that the targets were too large, and that they didn't really provide a realistic exercise. How did you feel about it from the trainee end?
I can't possibly remember. Mm-hmm. The only thing I remember, that particular practice, which you work with from a light tank, which I took part in later, enormous attention was paid to the speed with which you did it. And I can't imagine anything really in action which corresponded very closely to the extraordinary sort of manoeuvre you went through in trying to get all these rounds off in a short period of time.
Yes. You had at Bovington a tactical course, which you described last time as a load of rubbish. What did you mean exactly?
Well, all I seem to remember about it was that either when one got to one's unit afterwards, or certainly when one finally got involved in actually fighting a war, it didn't bear any relation whatever to anything that actually happened on the battlefield.
Was it a tactical training course orientated to the independent mobile role of tanks? Or
I can't remember.
No. Okie doke. Your first battalion posting was in October 35 to the 2nd Battalion at Farnborough. Did you find battalion service stimulating and exciting?
I found it much more interesting and much more fun. This was perhaps very largely due to the fact that because of the recent expansion of the Royal Tank Corps, when they'd formed the first tanks out of the light companies of the 2nd, 3rd and 5th, as a second lieutenant, I found myself with my own section, the light section of the company, and entirely on my own in that section, so I had much more responsibility than I would normally have done. And you had splendid soldiers. They were extremely good soldiers. And a very good commanding officer. I had a pretty dreary company commander for a time. But on the whole, it was, at last, you were doing what you had been going through. First of all, 18 months at Sandhurst, and then 6 months, slightly more, at Bovington to do. A great sort of sigh of relief that at last you're actually doing the job instead of continuing to be a schoolboy.
Mm. Did you get this appointment as a section commander immediately?
Straight away, yes. Yeah. Because they had sent a whole lot for two reasons. One was that they had expanded by forming this light battalion the year, I think it was the year before, or maybe it was earlier that year, and that had taken off a whole lot of officers. And of course the autumn was the trooping season. It was the time when officers were posted to India or Egypt, mostly India, to join companies there. Mm. And the other ones hadn't come back. So there was a shortage of officers in the battalion. Mm. I mean, in my company, there was only one officer in the light section, one in the medium section, I think. Well, there may have been two in the medium section, and one who doubled doing second in command with commanding the close support section, I think.
Had the training of Bovington adequately prepared you to command a section, do you think?
The training at Bovington had really had very little to do at all with the command side. That was what one was supposed to have learned at Sandhurst. And the rather maddening thing was that the actual vehicles I had in my section when I joined were not the ones I'd been trained on at Bovington. So the actual mechanical training, except in principle, and certain bits were the same, I had to learn over again.
I see. You describe the equipment of the section as a pretty scratch collection. What, in fact, did it consist of?
Well, I think I'm right in saying that most of the vehicles, when I took over, were the Carden Lloyd carrier. Because, of course, as I said, the light tanks had gone off to form the 1st Tank Battalion, which was a light tank battalion completely. It was formed as a sort of reconnaissance battalion for the tank brigade. And they'd taken all the light tanks away. So that when I first arrived, there were quite a lot of Carden Lloyd carriers. And I can't remember if there were any light tanks at all. There may have been one or two. The section was supposed to be 10, I think. It was certainly supposed to be at least 7. But over the following 2 years, this improved, and we were equipped so that by the time I left the 2nd to go to the 1st in February 1938, we'd been through most of the two-man light tanks, and were in fact by that time getting the three-man light tanks, the Mark 5s, and even Mark 6s, I think, I'm not sure.
Were these tanks fitted with wireless?
Oh, yes. Well, originally, no, not every one. Originally, I think at the time, the Carden Lloyd carrier was not. I think at the time I took over, there was meant to be one in every subsection, that's to say, three or four in the section out of 7 or 10 tanks. But this was only a temporary situation. Certainly by the time I left in the second tanks in at the beginning of 1938, every tank had a radio set.
Mm-hmm. Were the radio sets fitted and left in the tanks throughout the year?
Oh, no. Not even throughout the year. I mean, I think the drill was those days you took them out every time you brought the tank into the hangar and put in the store. Certainly one of the principal things one had to learn on one's wireless course, and I went on a wireless instructor's course at the end of 35, at the end of 30, no, I can't remember, in 36. One of the principal problems was this awful problem of assembling and reassembling the set with all its leads and everything. Now I think when you came off an exercise, you took the whole thing out and put it into store.
So they were only fitted in the vehicles for the period of the training
for an exercise
season.
I think.
I see. Good.
Well, they certainly went into store in the winter. Mm. Yes.
How satisfactory were the sets you had at that time?
Oh, pretty unsatisfactory. Particularly the ones in the medium tanks. They were a terrible thing. It's called an MBMC set, made up of 8 different bits, all of which had to be connected together with 99 individual leads. And you had to know which lead on one box went onto which terminal on another box. This was a sort of game intended to make life difficult for one, I think. The ones in the light tanks were simpler But the problem was that they were very easily thrown off net by vibration, and if you went over a bad bump, you were continually having to retune them, and they were fairly weak in power. Still, they worked. You could make them work.
I was reading the report of the 1934 summer exercises in the Tank Corps history, and I noticed in the Tank Corps history that about 1935 Hobart began a fairly intensive propaganda campaign to improve the effectiveness of RTC personnel in using wireless, and he coined the slogan, and I quote, "If you really believe in wireless, it will work," which kind of implies that one of the problems with wireless may have been human.
Well, I think that this was all connected with the lack of enthusiasm of the Royal Corps of Signals for trying to make sets work in tanks on the move. I think their basic idea was that you ought to stop in order to transmit at least, even if not to receive. And this, of course, was a hopeless idea. And it was largely for that reason, I think, that at Hobo's insistence, at about this time, the Royal Tank Corps took over the responsibility of operating its own sets from the Royal Signals, leaving only the rear link at battalion headquarters to brigade headquarters to be operated by the Royal Signals. And it was certainly, I went on the second, I think, not the first, but I went on only the second wireless instructor's course at Bovington. And when I came back, I and another officer and a corporal who'd done a course in India had to train all the radio operators of the battalion from absolute scratch. And we hadn't had any before.
Can you tell me a bit about the course? What sort of equipment were you trained on? Was there any new equipment around?
Well, we were trained on the MBMC set for the medium tank, which I've talked about. Mm-hmm. And the set for the light tank then was, I think, the number one set, which was quite a small set. There was another larger set which came into service a bit later with the three-man light tank. Name I can't remember now, the number six set, I think. But as far as I remember, the course was on the MBMC, the number one, and possibly one other set, but I can't remember which.
Was the range and performance of the light tank sets comparable to the MBMC sets?
Yes, as far as I can remember, I think it was a bit bigger. I mean, a bit longer range, I think.
Mm-hmm. And what was the purpose of the course exactly?
Of the course was to train instructors to train operators.
Mm-hmm. Was that purely a technical course, or did it bring in sort of tactical use of wireless for communication in the field?
It brought in the whole thing, yes. Mm.
What sort of philosophy was being propounded at that time as regards control and coordination through wireless?
Well, I think then everybody was firmly of the opinion that all the sets in the battalion should be on the same frequency. This, I don't remember arguments then, although they occurred quite soon afterwards, as to whether this was right and whether one ought not to have separate company frequencies. The cavalry from the moment they became mechanized, favored the separate squadron frequencies from the start. And this persisted all through the war.
Why was that? What were the merits of the alternative cases?
Well, the merit of separate squadron frequencies was that, of course, different squadrons could talk within the squadrons without interrupting some other squadron. The merit of having the whole battalion on the same frequency, of course, was everybody can hear everything that's going on. But it does demand a very, very much stricter and tighter wireless discipline. I mean, you can't have people going waffling on. And it very much depends, in my opinion, on what the task is you're actually doing.
For example?
In retrospect, I think we may have clung to the clung to the battalion net longer than we might have done, I don't know. But certainly, I mean, if, for instance, you were supporting infantry, and one squadron was supporting one battalion and one another, of course you would have a separate squadron frequencies.